All right, I think we've got it now. A special coast-to-coast happy birthday to Big Joe of Huntington Beach, who turns 39 today. Hope you had a great birthday, Big Joe. And happy Thanksgiving to Coast Canadians listeners. My name is Richard Serrett, and thanks for inviting me into your home. If you're listening south of the 49th parallel or up in Alaska, let me assure you, no, you're not listening to a repeat broadcast of Coast to Coast. We're live from Toronto, and way up here in the Great White North, we celebrate Thanksgiving tonight and tomorrow. Yes, Thanksgiving in October. By the way, is there anyone out there who can tell me what that strange mint jelly mold with chunks of pineapple in it's all about? And who thought of putting melted marshmallows on top of sweet potatoes was a good idea? So again, if you're wondering why Canadians celebrate Thanksgiving in October, it has something to do with the English explorer Martin Frobisher, who back in 1758, he and his crew were in search of the Northwest Passage, and one night while they were freezing in the dark, they gave thanks for their well-being. And if you did eat your bird earlier this evening, I hope you didn't ingest too much tryptophan. Otherwise, you'll drift off and miss the program. I know I always get very drowsy after eating my turkey dinner. And actually tonight, one of our dinner guests with a college degree pointed out that I'd have to consume about 45 pounds of turkey in order for the tryptophan to have its narcoleptic effect. To which I replied, yeah, what's your point? Have you seen me eat? Maybe this whole turkey and tryptophan is a conspiracy to keep us all drowsy and dopey. Never mind tryptophan. Tonight we're talking dimethyltryptamine. Try dimethyltryptamine, as in the psychedelic compound also known as DMT. It's the simplest classical of all psychedelics, and it comes from a family of compounds that also includes LSD, psilocybin, or magic mushrooms, and mescaline. DMT is widespread throughout the planet kingdom. Hundreds, if not thousands, of species possess it. And many indigenous cultures in Latin America use DMT-containing plants for their psychedelic properties in healing, recreation, hunting, and spiritual practices. The Amazon psychedelic tea ayahuasca contains DMT as its visionary ingredient, but DMT also occurs in every mammal that scientists have studied, including humans. That's right, DMT is produced in our bodies, most likely in the pineal gland. And it seems it's essential for normal brain functioning. But in the early to mid-90s, Dr. Rick Strassman, who has a doctorate in psychiatry and a fellowship in psychopharmacology, conducted the first new human studies with psychedelic drugs in the United States in more than 20 years. He focused on the naturally occurring compound DMT. Out of that groundbreaking research came a groundbreaking book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. A doctor's revolutionary research into the biology of near-death and mystical experiences. 14 years later, Dr. Strassman is back with a follow-up to that book. It's called DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, a new science of spiritual revelation in the Hebrew Bible. We'll find out what dimethyltryptamine has to do with such Old Testament prophets as Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Daniel, and more when Dr. Strassman joins us in hours 2, 3, and 4. But first, coming up in hour one, the untold story of the birth of the Predator drone, or unmanned aerial vehicles. Of course, the use of the Predator drone by the CIA to kill known and suspected terrorists, some of them U.S. citizens, continues with no judicial or congressional oversight, and it continues to fuel fierce debates not only in the United States but around the world. And we'll certainly get into that when Richard Whittle joins us shortly. Richard covered the Pentagon and other Washington beats for nearly 20 years with the Dallas Morning News, and his new book, Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution, chronicles the saga of an extraordinary aircraft, but also a story of invention, a story of war, the story of the Air Force, the CIA, and the story of how a new age in aviation began. The Predator is also the first weapon in history whose operators can fly it by remote control above the other side of the globe and use it, much like a sniper, to stalk and kill a single individual from a position of utter invulnerability. But this revolutionary piece of military hardware wasn't a creation of the evil military-industrial complex. It actually began elsewhere, in a garage. The Predator was invented and transformed into a world-changing technology by a cast of characters no novelist could conjure up. And this cast of characters, mostly iconoclasts and heretics, opened up to Richard and allowed him to tell their story. Hopefully, the tryptophan from your turkey feast has worn off, because we're about to embark on quite a journey. From the Old Testament to the psychedelic compounds like dimethyltryptamine, to the world of drones, unmanned aerial vehicles, snipers in the sky. Any way you look at it, this broadcast promises to be, well, trippy. I'm Richard Serrett, and you're listening to Coast to Coast AM. Richard Whittle, author of The Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution, and The Dream Machine, The Untold History of the Notorious V-22 Osprey, is a 2013-2014 Alfred V. Vervel Fellow at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, a contributor to Air and Space Smithsonian, the website Breaking Defense, and other publications. And from 1984 to 2006, he covered the Pentagon and other Washington beats for the Dallas Morning News. He previously covered defense and foreign policy for Congressional Quarterly and was an editor of National Public Radio. His articles have been published in the Christian Science Monitor, a wide range of other newspapers and magazines, and on the Atlantic Monthly website. Richard Whittle, welcome to Coast to Coast. I appreciate you spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me, Richard. I'm glad to be here.
When many people hear the word drone, they think of the CIA targeting Al-Qaeda operatives and in some cases, U.S. citizens that were deemed an imminent threat to the security of the United States. But before we get into the Predator, which is but one type of unmanned aerial vehicle, give us a sense of how prevalent drones are. Who has them and how are they being used?
Well, Richard, you know, we're in a new age of drones that began with the arming of the Predator and rigging it for global remote control. You know, drones have been around actually since World War I. There have been various drones attempted by the military over the years. But when the Predator was armed, and the story I tell in my book is how the Predator was invented, how it was armed, and the intention was to use it to kill Osama bin Laden. But when the war in Afghanistan began on October 7th, 2001, the United States military had 82 drones, 82 unmanned aerial vehicles, as they call them, and three of those were armed, three Predators. And there were only three types of drones that the military had. Now, today, the U.S. military alone has more than 10,000, ranging in size, you know, from handheld drones with cameras on them to the Global Hawk, which is basically the size of a 737, and that's an unarmed drone used for reconnaissance. You know, the estimates vary, but anywhere from 70 to 80 nations around the world are building their own military drones now. It's a quite dramatic proliferation, and we know that Russia and Israel have armed drones and are believed to have used them in lethal operations. The Chinese have developed their own knockoff of the Predator called the Pterodactyl. Looks almost exactly the same. And Iran claims to be making progress building drones. So it's quite a phenomenon. And that's why my book is called Predator, The Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution, because the Predator opened the door to all this.
Well, as you point out, Air and Space Smithsonian Magazine named the Predator as one of the 10 aircrafts that changed the world. That's quite a statement. Is that true in your estimation, and if so, why?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I mean, start with the numbers I just gave you about the proliferation of drones. But, you know, in the old days, drones were sort of a niche technology. The military actually started developing them in World War I with a little biplane, a couple of different kinds, actually. But one that's memorable is called the Kettering Bug, which was a biplane not much larger than a go-kart. That was supposed to be loaded with explosives and flown out over the ocean to protect us from German ships. During the 20s and 30s, as radio control came along, the Hollywood actor Reginald Denny created a company to build target drones for the Army to train anti-aircraft gunners, and built thousands of those up through World War II. And that's one role that drones have continued in all along, and they still exist that way. In the Vietnam War, we had jet-powered drones called Fireflies and Firebees and Lightning Bugs, and most carried still photo cameras, but a couple were armed. They weren't used to any great effect, and those drones flew more than 3,400 missions in Vietnam. Most only lasted about four missions before they were shot down or crashed. And unlike the Predator, they weren't real airplanes. They couldn't take off and land, on their own landing gear from a runway. So the Predator changed things in a couple of major ways, which I trust we'll talk about. But one is it was a real airplane as opposed to a small little drone.
Well, let's start with a bit of a thumbnail sketch and the genesis of the Predator and how it started off as just kind of a remote control airplane with a camera on it to the point where it's now firing Hellfire missiles.
Yeah, well, I tell you, it's a fascinating story. And when I started this book 5 years ago, and I had no idea the cast of characters I would meet and also the oddities of the story, because I thought, that unmanned aerial vehicles, as the military was calling them then, were produced by the usual suspects. But turned out there's a man named Abraham Karam, who I write about at length in my book. He was born in 1937 in Baghdad, but he grew up in Israel. And in his early 30s, in the early 70s, he was the chief of special projects at Israel Aircraft Industries. And in the Yom Kippur War of 1973, the Egyptians and Syrians shot down 100 Israeli fighter planes, and the Israeli Air Force was desperate for a way to counter them. And Abe Karam was given the assignment to develop an unmanned decoy, a drone decoy that could be flown into the teeth of Syrian and Egyptian air defenses so that their radars would light up and Israeli planes carrying anti-radar missiles could find them. He was inspired by that project, Richard, to actually leave his job and start a company to create drones. He had no success in Israel, so he immigrated to the United States, the land of opportunity, and went to work, as all American inventors seem to do, in his garage, as you mentioned in the opening. His was in Los Angeles. And working there, he came up with a drone that had a feature other drones hadn't had, phenomenal flight endurance, a little drone he called the Albatross that could fly for up to 48 hours without landing to refuel. And this was the beginning of the revolution, because this capability of hanging in the air for long periods of time was what made the Predator special and what makes the Predator a larger derivative now called the Reaper and the Global Hawk, for instance, very important to the military today, their ability to hang in the sky for long periods of time. And that's how it got started. Abe Karam in his garage, he got a contract from the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency to build a larger drone. He was unable ultimately to sell it to the military, where, as I'm sure you know, there's been great resistance, or was great resistance, to this kind of technology. And he went bankrupt in 1990. So the story might have ended there.
Except, well, it is remarkable, because your previous book on the V-22, the Osprey, which is this tilt-a-rotor multi-purpose military aircraft that has turned into a success story. It didn't start out that way, as you've pointed out. 25 years in the making, $30 billion, 30 lives lost, which is kind of unfortunately, a shining example of everything that's wrong with the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
And then along comes the drone, which is sort of the antithesis of that. We're going to take a break here, Rick. When we come back, I want you to talk to that about how the military-industrial complex works and how the drone is maybe a new chapter in that whole saga. Rick Whittle is with us, the author of Predator, The Secret Origins. Oh, we've got a couple minutes here. We can get into that now, actually.
Okay.
So the Osprey, it was It was a horror show in the beginning.
Yeah, well, I call it an ugly duckling that's turned into a swan. You know, as you said, it took more than two decades for the Marine Corps to get it into action, and $25 billion and 30 people lost their lives in crashes. And part of the problem with the Osprey was the politics of defense contracting. For the Marine Corps to get that aircraft started, they had to get buy-in from the other services. They had to prove to Congress it was going to be a joint program. They had to develop support in Congress, which they did, that kept the Osprey alive despite its problems. And then because they had so many people involved, they had to write what are called requirements that would fit the missions. That the Osprey originally was supposed to do 10 different missions for 4 different armed services. So, you know, it was supposed to be even more than a Swiss Army knife. And that's a very hard thing to do for what, in fact, was a revolutionary technology. This tilt rotor, the Osprey has 2 big rotors on its wingtips. It takes off like a helicopter, tilts them forward, and flies like an airplane, which allows it to overcome the natural limitations of helicopter rotors and fly usually twice as fast as any other military helicopter.
All right, we've got that music percolating up here, Rick, so we'll step away for a few moments, come back, and continue to delve into the secret origins of the drone revolution. Rick Whittle, my guest, here on Coast to Coast AM. Tom Petty takes us into the break. Welcome back. I am the host of The Conspiracy Show, which airs up here in Toronto on AM 740, Zoomer Radio. And I also have a television program of the same name, which airs across Canada on Vision TV and now available in about 110 markets down in the United States. So as they say, check your local listings. We came back with the Eagles in a song called How Long from a much anticipated album that was about 30 years in the making, I think. It was called Long Road Out of Eden. And, you know, Eagles aren't the only ones that can make music. Tim Banalas posted a great story up on the coasttocoastam.com website in the hot story section. It's called Whale Song Explained. Humpbacks are able to synchronize their music across oceans, and there's even sheet music to prove it. But apparently the sharks own all the publishing rights. Isn't that always the way? The feature story is a secret space mission ends after nearly 2 years in space. The Air Force's clandestine craft known as X-37B returns to Earth this week. And finally, the video featured on coasttocoastam.com dovetails nicely with our discussion tonight about the drone predator. There's a great video of a hawk attacking a drone. It was posted to YouTube this week, and it depicts the moment a hawk attacks a drone in flight over a Massachusetts park. So check out the footage at coasttocoastam.com. Thanks to Tim Banal for posting these great stories. And back with my conversation with Rick Whittle as we discuss the secret origins of the Predator drone right here on Coast to Coast. And we are back with Rick Whittle as we discuss the secret origins of the Predator drone. Rick, how difficult was it for you to get some of these innovators involved in the development of the drone, of the Predator, to open up to you? Were they a suspicious lot?
Well, to some extent, the book took me 5 years, and part of the problem was that I was trying to tell a story that some people in the Air Force and of course the CIA didn't really want told, in some aspects, because in the latter part of my book, I describe how when the war in Afghanistan began, the Air Force had a ground control station for a Predator actually parked on the CIA campus in Langley, Virginia, with a double-wide mobile home next to it that was used as a command center for the Air Force. And I explain how they ended up there. You know, originally, the story gets a little complex because we're going backward, but in 2000, a man named Dick Clark, who was at the National Security Council, and a CIA official named Charlie Allen were trying very hard to come up with a way for the United States to kill Osama bin Laden. And the first challenge was to find him, because they knew he was in Afghanistan, but it was hard to get him in the CIA sites. And so it was decided that they would send an unarmed Predator to look for him. By that time, the military had been using the Predator for about 5 years. And a secretive organization that I discovered, I'd never known them before, though I covered the military for 30 years, an organization called Big Safari within the Air Force, had been working on the Predator. A Big Safari crew and some Air Force intelligence officers set up at Ramstein Air Base in Germany and flew an unarmed Predator over Afghanistan in September and October of 2000. And they found Osama bin Laden. Well, Richard, when they did that, then an Air Force project to arm the Predator, which had been stalled because of a dispute with the State Department over whether it was legal under arms control treaties, that got put into high gear when Richard Clark of the National Security Council, the chief counterterrorism advisor at the time, and Charlie Allen of the CIA started pushing this idea. And in the spring and summer of 2001, I describe in great detail in the book how the Air Force, Big Safari in particular, worked with General Atomics to modify the Predator so that it could carry two 105-pound Hellfire missiles, each with a 20-pound warhead. These are missiles, by the way, that were designed to be fired by helicopters at low altitude, and the Predator would be firing them at anywhere from 10 to 20,000 feet. So there was a lot of work that had to be done, and I was fortunate to be able to get people who were involved in the project to talk to me and give me details. And actually, I would suggest that your listeners might want to go to a website called richardwhittle.net, where they can see a timeline of all this and some, to me, fascinating photographs that I was able to gather that show some of the Predator testing, including videos of some of the test shots. And so this was how this now when they decided that they were going to try to send an armed Predator to kill Osama bin Laden, and by the way, this was months before 9/11, a lawyer at the Pentagon said, well, you can't pull the trigger on German soil. And so a man whose name I was not able to use in the book, but who helped me greatly, I call him a techno-scientist, I gave him the alias Werner. For the book, Werner came up with a way to move the ground control station from Germany to the United States, and that is how we obtained this ability to control drones on the other side of the planet and fire missiles at people. It all was developed actually as a result of what you might call a conspiracy to kill Osama bin Laden.
Now, I think we tend to forget that the drone, the Predator, is being used. You know, it's being used by the Army, the Air Force, but it's also being used by the CIA, and which gets us into this whole discussion about presidential hit lists and the use of the drone to target U.S. citizens that have been deemed a threat to U.S. national security. Do you think the drone, the Predator, now has gotten a black eye as a result of that, or are you a booster of the Predator and its uses?
Well, I'm not a booster nor a detractor. I mean, it's a technology that exists. You know, it's here. I think that it presents problems for us as a society, and targeted killing is one of them. You know, the targeted killing was not something that the CIA had wanted to get involved in since the 1970s, when assassination plots they'd been involved in were revealed. And in fact, there was an executive order banning assassinations by U.S. officials that was modified when the decision was made that we needed to kill Osama bin Laden before he killed more Americans. You know, the Al-Qaeda had bombed the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. So, Richard Clark and others started pushing this idea that the United States needed to kill Osama bin Laden, but they, you know, they had it in mind as a sort of isolated case. I think I don't think anyone envisioned that we would get to the point where the president would be maintaining a hit list, in effect, and the Justice Department and the Defense Department would be involved, and other agencies of the executive branch would be involved in putting together kill lists. You know, and I think that it's sort of this system evolved in a way that it cries out for some debate and possibly legislation. I mean, you know, technically, Richard, this these activities are reported to Congress, but they're only reported to a handful of members, and it's my understanding that they're not allowed to even talk to their staffs about what they're told. So it seems to me that you know, we need better checks and balances on this. I think you mentioned the lack of judicial and congressional oversight in the opening, and I agree. I think we need. I'm among other things, a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, and the president of the Wilson Center, Jane Harman, a former congresswoman from California, has argued that we need to take the system that's used where a judge has to approve warrants for wiretaps for under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, domestic wiretaps, and we need to extend that to drone strikes. You know, we need to at least have a judge review the evidence that ends up in someone being put on the hit list.
Has this debate spilled over into the commercial use of drones or the use of drones by, let's say, civilian police agencies? Because I know that the Congress has set a deadline for the FAA by September of next year to integrate commercial drones into U.S. airspace. And
right.
First, maybe you can tell us what that means, integrate commercial drones.
Yeah, well, it's a, you know, that's a question that a lot of people would like answered. Congress said that the FAA should safely integrate unmanned aircraft systems, as they call them, UAS, into the National Civilian Airspace System by September 30th, 2015. They're not going to meet that deadline because there are two major issues that these aircraft raise. Now, first of all, let's say, let me point out, NOAA is talking about using armed drones within U.S. airspace for law enforcement or other purposes. But law enforcement certainly wants to use unarmed drones to aid its work, and a lot of people want to use them for commercial purposes. But there are two problems. There's the safety of our airspace. Because unlike manned aircraft, a drone has no one on board who can see and avoid other aircraft, which is the fundamental safety rule. And then there's the question of privacy. You know, the way these little drones are now, you get a little quadcopter with a tiny camera on it, and it can't fly very long, maybe 20 or 45 minutes, but you can use it to fly it over your neighbor's fence and peek in the window if you want. So not legally, but you know. So we need to, as a society, we need to come up with, we need to debate this new technology, and we need to come up with ways to regulate it. But for all these reasons, but to go back to what you're asking about the FAA, they recently approved applications by six Hollywood film companies to be able to use drones on their sets. And the FAA was happy to do that because that's actually safer than letting film companies use helicopters and things like that. Helicopters or manned aircraft of other types. You know, the drones are smaller, they're quieter, they're less dangerous should they fall to the ground. And there are other commercial interests who would like to use drones right now. That's not legal. Law enforcement in many places wants to use them, and you know, we're getting sort of a hodgepodge of laws and resolutions around the United States, in which, for example, the state of North Carolina, the General Assembly there passed a law recently that essentially gives law enforcement the right to use drones to conduct surveillance of public gatherings without any kind of warrant or anything. At the same time, Charlottesville, Virginia, across the border and a few dozen miles north of North Carolina, the city council passed a resolution banning the use of drones for surveillance within the city limits of Charlottesville. So, you know, I think we're struggling with this new technology, probably as people struggled initially, not as much, but or not as much at that time when powered flight came along. You know, we had to have airports, we had to have regulations, we had to create the FAA, et cetera. And we're at a stage here with a new revolutionary technology that is outstripping the government's ability to regulate it.
So then I'm not going to be able to order Predator, the Secret Origins of the Drone Revolution, from Amazon delivered by a drone in the foreseeable future?
Well, not within the next couple of years, at least. That may happen, and it's an interesting thing because, you know, this it's going to depend on whether they can come up with a safe way for small drones to deliver packages, particularly in urban areas. And one idea that I've heard they're looking at is to have trucks that would drive down the street, and then a whole squadron of drones would take off from that truck and go make deliveries and come back, pre-programmed, you know, because the driver going from the truck to the door is the most expensive part of the delivery process. DHL, the German delivery company, sort of German equivalent of FedEx and UPS, has started using a small little drone called the parcel copter, to deliver medicine to an island in the North Sea off the coast of Germany as an experiment. Other countries are moving ahead of the United States in getting commercial uses of drones underway.
But aside from the commercial use, then let's go back to the ability to use these unmanned aerial vehicles as snipers in the sky. Mm-hmm. What is to stop some terrorist organization or some rogue nation from using a drone against targets in the United States?
Yeah, well, this is a reason I hope my book makes a contribution to public understanding of this technology, because I tell the story of how this ability to target and stalk and kill someone on the other side of the globe came about. And, you know, it's not, despite, I think, popular illusions, it's not as simple as subscribing to satellite TV. This techno-scientist Werner, who worked for this weird organization, Big Safari, came up with the method that the U.S. uses, and the signals actually go by fiber optic cable under the Atlantic Ocean to Europe, where they meet up with a satellite Earth terminal and then go up to a satellite and then down to the drone. And that's necessary because you can't use one satellite to get to the other side of the globe, and you can't hopscotch from satellite to satellite, because then you create so much latency in the signal, delay in the signal, that you couldn't accurately fly the aircraft or fire its missiles. So all that is by way of background to say that I don't think that we're in danger of other countries being able to use Predator drones over U.S. Territory the way we have used them over Afghanistan and Pakistan and Yemen and places like that, for two reasons. One, the communications technology is going to be beyond the means of most countries. And even if a larger country, let's say Russia or China, were able to put a system like that together and could secrete airplanes large enough to carry bombs and missiles to some place in Mexico or Canada where they could take off and get to U.S. airspace, our air defenses are such that we would probably be able to shoot them down, because an Air Force general told me the Predator, you know, is actually it's a fairly flimsy aircraft, made of composite materials, very lightweight, 2,300 pounds, I think. And an Air Force general told me the easiest way to shoot a Predator down is to fly next to it in a helicopter with a 12-gauge shotgun.
So, pretty low tech.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It really is. And it flies very slowly, 82 miles an hour, roughly, is cruising speed. You know, but what's been phenomenal about it has been the ability for it to loiter in the sky for, you know, 20, 24 hours or more hanging over a target and watching with the cameras, and for that to be streamed back to command centers and to the, not just to the ground control station, but, you know, into the Pentagon, into the CIA headquarters, into the White House, even, so that commanders can watch it. And this brings up another point, Richard, I'd like to make. You know, there's a lot of fear of what I think Bill Maher has called robot killer aircraft. These are not robots. There are a lot of people, there are a lot of humans in the loop in flying these aircraft. It takes like 55 people to keep one in the air. And then there are commanders all up and down the line who are deciding whether a target is valid and giving the order to fire. It's not the young captain and the sensor operator sitting in a ground control station somewhere. And they're not playing a video game either. One of the people I interviewed for my book is a young man named Scott Swanson. He fired the first drone strike ever in Afghanistan on the first night of the war, October 7, 2001. He also was at the controls when the Predator found Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. And Scott told me, you know, he remembers the bodies flying in the air during that first drone strike. And, you know, this is 13 years later, and I think that, you know, he still thinks about that. It's no video game.
Well, you know, in some strange way, that's good to know. I mean, you know, that there is still a human element to all of this. I've just got in 15 seconds, if you could, how do you foresee the drone being used in our war against ISIL?
Increasingly, I think that a lot have been flown over there now, as ISIL fighters retreat and melt into the population, having drones overhead to look for them, and then if they can be found, launch precision strikes will be important.
Great. Rick Whittle, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Richard.
DMT and the Soul of Prophecy with Dr. Rick Strassman when Coast to Coast AM continues.